Jane Latour on August 4th, 2005, interviewing Connie Terrell in North Bend, Oregon. Just want to correct, this is Connie. Okay. So let's hope for the best and go forward. Where were you born and what year?
I was born in New York City, February 11th, 1948, the year that Truman desegregated the military. I was born in, not in Manhattan, but on what they call Roosevelt Island now.
Okay.
At that time there were hospitals, and since my mother lived in Spanish Harlem, she had to take a ferry over to Roosevelt Island. And at that time it was just all hospitals and insane asylums.
And
I was born in a major snowstorm.
Okay. And when what were your parents doing for their occupations?
At that time, my father was a printer on the La Prensa newspaper, which is the biggest Spanish newspaper. My mother basically worked in factories, garment factories. And both my parents were politically active. My father was an anarcho-syndicalist who'd escaped from Spain, you know. In fact, he came to America illegally, which is why how he married my mother. They had this arranged marriage. And since she was from Puerto Rico, you know, citizen, he married her, even though he didn't have papers. And my mother was a Puerto Rican nationalist. In fact, my whole family was very political.
So, did you have siblings?
Yes, I have. I had a brother and a sister. I now have another brother, but he's a baby and he wasn't raised with us. But yes, it was three of them.
And was the printing job a union job, La Prensa?
At that time, it was. But during the McCarthy era, my father was persecuted, and they kicked him out of the country. They wanted to send him back to Spain, but that would have been a death sentence because Franco would have killed him. So a legal deal was worked out. I mean, I was very young. I was about five, but this is what I've been told, you know, about that time period, that a deal was cut and they allowed my father to go to Cuba. He had to spend a year there processing his paperwork to then come back into the United States legally, even though, you know, he was communist, according to them. Well, actually, he was, except he was an anarchist.
Was your mom
and then once he came back to the country, we really almost starved to death. Once he came back, then, interestingly enough, because of his pop, he ended up working as a custodian for the Police Athletic League forever. Because he was a really good carpenter and good fixer.
So, was your mom active with the garment workers, or was she a member of the garment workers?
She was in the garment workers union. She was not active in the union. She was in the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party. She was active in nationalist.
Okay. What kind of education did you get?
I went to Catholic school and then public school, then City College, then Carpenter's College, and then went here in Oregon. I went back to school.
Did you graduate from City College?
Yes.
Yeah. What year?
1973.
Okay. So you were already college educated when you went into the carpenter.
Oh, yeah.
What did you study?
Psychology.
Oh, that makes sense.
Well, history of psychology.
So would you care to characterize your politics, or is that too broad a question?
No, I'm pretty straightforward about it. I spent a great deal of my life trying to overthrow the United States government. What do you do? Well, yeah, that's what I do. I consider myself, you know, a socialist, and haven't changed my views. You know, I know a lot of people say, oh, the older you get, the more you change your views. No, no, I think that we live under a system that creates injustice. Just because of what the system is itself, it can't help itself but create injustice. Mm-hmm. And you know, most of you know social ills and the horrors that we live under. It's like, what? So somebody can buy you know a $10 million bed. You know, like mm-hmm. Leona Helmsley did.
Yeah.
When I was working in construction, she bought a $10 million bed, mm-hmm. and I remember the time we were all mm-hmm. kind of talking about it
right.
on the jobs, and it was like. Who the hell needs a $10 million? And how can you sleep on $10 million bed?
Yeah. Whew. Apparently,
no.
Leona can.
Yeah.
So, did you, when you were growing up, you said your dad was a carpenter. Did you do any work with him?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah. In fact, because I was the oldest, my father's view is I was his helpmate. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's like, what do you do with the oldest son?
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was the youngest. He was the baby. So, yeah, in fact, every summer I would go to work with my dad, and we painted this gymnasium that was one of his contracts that he had. With, you know, when I think about it now, how much lead paint, you know.
Yeah, right.
And I remember as a child when I was working with my dad that at the end of the day, we would wash our hands in turpentine and benzene,
mm-hmm.
which now they say is incredibly carcinogenic,
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
and I used to love the smell of benzene,
yeah.
and you know,
got
just
you high.
Washing my hand, not so much because mm-hmm. it'll give you a headache, but
mm-hmm.
I you know,
yeah.
nasty oil, all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, what about working experience before you went into the carpenters?
I started working, my very first job, actual paying job, I did in the summer when I was 12 years old with illegal working papers, which my aunt got, who knows, the woman was amazing. She was a floor lady, foreman.
Mm-hmm.
In,
your mother's sister?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really, I was, in the same family back then, but I was raised, more by my aunt than my mother because my mother really didn't stay around that much. She was
mm-hmm.
kind of in and out of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
She was more than home life. And so my aunt and my grandmother were there when they actually did the parenting. And so my aunt got these papers for me and I was able to work. Supposedly a 16-year-old. There's no way I didn't
mm-hmm.
even look. And I started working in the garment factory. First, it was cutting threads
mm-hmm.
and putting on tags. It's all piecework.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, when we were little, I remember my mother used to bring home these bolts of material that had these little, kind of like these little lace. Things. They were sort of like, it was these little lace pieces that got sewn onto ladies' underwear,
mm-hmm.
you know, slips and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were decorative pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And, God.
Yeah.
I remember.
Well, this is a strange experience, but. Okay, so.
Already groups to get into construction.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go out with them and stuff, so it was like...
Who were you working with to get people into construction? Fight Back, or...
Yeah, I worked with Fight Back. I worked
RTP.
With...
RTP?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
all the groups.
Uh-huh.
I was with the Workers Viewpoint Organization at
okay.
the time, so it was a, you know, actually a Maoist
okay.
Marxist Leninist
uh-huh.
organization, but mostly Maoist.
Uh-huh.
And so there were all these building projects going on in our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Like I lived in the neighborhood.
Was that still Spanish Harlem?
No, this is the Lower East Side.
Oh, okay.
Chinatown. Okay. This was AFI,
mm-hmm.
you know, Asian Americans for I can't remember now, but really AFI was the front organization for Workers' Viewpoint Organization. Mm-hmm. Workers' Viewpoint was our Marxist, Maoist organization. Then we had this community organization that helped people find jobs. We taught English. I taught English to Chinese garment mm-hmm. workers, you know, volunteering. We would do taxes. I was one of the people who was instrumental in organizing that huge, huge demonstration against the police. Remember when it was about, I don't know, I think it was about, almost 30,000 people demonstrating against the Fifth Precinct because they were brutalizing the Chinese community.
Okay.
I don't know if you remember
mm-hmm.
that.
I wasn't in New York.
Yeah, that was great. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was really fantastic. Mm-hmm.
So, but there was a conscious effort to get some of those jobs for
minority mm-hmm. men.
Yeah.
Minority
mm-hmm.
men. Interestingly enough, for me,
mm-hmm.
the Marxist organization I belonged to were furious. They did not want me to go into construction. They wanted to work. At that time, you know how doctrinaire mm-hmm. it was
yeah.
like they ordered people, you go there, you do
mm-hmm.
this,
right.
you know, and mm-hmm. I used to. I've always been the kind of person I go, no. And one of the things I used to always say to people in a lot of the leftist organizations mm-hmm. that I was around, and, look, we cannot offer working class people less democracy than capitalists are offering. And if you're going to come up with this, you know, Bolshevik or Maoist
mm-hmm.
structures, they will not work in this country. They won't work with me.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, yeah. that's a cult. Somebody's mm-hmm. ordering you got to leave it. And there was
yeah.
that, by the way, mm-hmm. at one point.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get? How did you decide to enter the Carpenters?
Well, I've been going around mm-hmm. with these groups,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a liaison person,
right.
you know, and demonstrating with them, getting arrested with them, beating the whole nine
mm-hmm.
yards, right? And I was looking for work, and I had lost my job. I had been working in the daycare center,
mm-hmm.
and looking for a job, couldn't find it. It was that time when it was just like a freeze
mm-hmm.
in New York City. And I thought, you know, I'm a damn good carpenter. You know, I mean, I was. I'd always fixed up my own apartments, knocked out walls,
mm-hmm.
you know, doing all kinds of stuff. I grew up using tools, comfortable
mm-hmm.
around tools. So I thought, well, why don't I go for a job?
Mm-hmm.
And when I made the decision that I wanted to do so, I talked to the people in my organization, and they were just, and then I started talking to my friends, and everybody was against it.
Mm-hmm.
I was told things like, this is by Marxists. I was told things like, well, sister, this, you know, you're taking a man's job away.
Yeah.
I'm looking going, the fuck are you mm-hmm. saying? Here I am, a single mother with two kids, and you're telling me I'm taking a man's job away? You know, and
okay, so I didn't even touch on that, because so you had two kids you were
yeah.
trying to support, okay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I was assuming you were a young, single woman.
No. I've never been young, and I've never been single.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much.
Okay.
I've been raising children since the age of three.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I have. You know the meaning of what it is to be young.
Yeah.
You know.
So you had your first child when you were how old?
I got married at 17
mm-hmm.
after I graduated. Well, 17 and a half after I graduated high school, and I had my son when I was 20.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So then, so how did you go about
my
getting into the Carpenters?
Well, since I had been going out with these
mm-hmm.
guys looking for
mm-hmm.
jobs. I then said to them, you know, the different guys from the organization, I said, you know, I want to work in construction. I want to break into construction. I'm going to go out with you guys, and I want to work. Boy, talk about resistance.
Yeah.
Here are the guys I had helped
mm-hmm.
the jobs. And I said, well, you know, why not? And they were,
yeah, you couldn't possibly.
Yeah. And so it took a very long time, and finally, what happened was a job came up that none of the men wanted.
Mm.
And the guys went, by fact, nobody wanted this job because it was only for 1 week.
Mm.
And I said, I'll take it. I hate them, you know, mm-hmm. I don't care. And when I, the day that I arrived on the job, this is what I find really interesting, is the field supervisor on the job, mm-hmm. was black, mm-hmm. and he was not black. Mm-hmm. Black man. Mm-hmm. And he said, they sent you, well, you can't work with it. And he made me sit in the office, and I sat in the office, and he was very nasty, very nasty. Mm-hmm. And
do you remember what job it was? Where it was?
Oh, yeah. It was on Cherry Street, and it was, it was a 19-story prefab concrete building. They brought the slabs, you know, the walls. Mm-hmm. It was something they were trying new, and it's mm-hmm. actually the tallest prefab building in this country, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then, did you eventually get to work on that job?
Well, what happened was, I sat the first day, mm-hmm. and then, you know, all the calls and this and that, you know, between the, because the way it worked back then, mm-hmm. to get a job, the minority groups would go out onto these job sites, and we were kind of picketing the job site, mm-hmm. saying, we're in our community, you know, and none of the jobs and none of the money is going to our mm-hmm. community. You people are coming in, making the money, and going to the suburbs, mm-hmm. right? Suburbs. The other piece of it, because you know New York is an incredibly political town. Mm-hmm. The other piece of it was that the settlement houses, okay, and the community organizations, which were two political bases mm-hmm. on the side, were also part of this kind of triangulated to force these mm-hmm. the unions and to force these uh-huh. companies to hire minorities. So they were putting pressure on also. So I guess he must have done a lot of phone calling, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. The next day I showed up, and they put me to work. Mm-hmm. The foreman, you know, had all my tools. And I, coming in as an apprentice, I mean, I wasn't in the union yet, because mm-hmm. I got the job right. first. I had all my tools. Mm-hmm. I know how to use tools. The foreman handed me a broom.
Oh, wow. Yeah. A real statement.
He hands me a broom mm-hmm. and he says, sweep out the shanty. All the men went off to their assignments and mm-hmm. he sweep out the shanty. Okay. Now I know what he was up to that way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And some of the minority men would fall for this, mm-hmm. which is what they would do is give you no work, you did your time, you collected your mm-hmm. paycheck, and you're out. Mm-hmm. And some guys go, oh, great, I don't have to bust my ass. Swept the shanty in 5 minutes, and I mean, beautiful. Swept it 5 minutes, went to look mm-hmm. for the foreman as it finished the job. He looked at me, because mm-hmm. he had expected me to go yeah. along with the yeah. game, right? So you don't want to get another one?
Well, let's do a little more.
Okay. Anyway, so he gave me some of a little piddly, mm-hmm. He gave me another job, right? Piddly job. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I was to bring boxes of screws, you know, mm-hmm. screws to the men on the floor. So I did that. Did it, boom, and I mean super fat. Ran, found the foreman. You can be, this would be a sitcom. And I said, finish the job, or job, I'm gonna go boss. And he looked at me, and he gave me another little mm-hmm. assignment. Ran, I did it, mm-hmm. super fast. Went, found them. We did this little song and dance. We did the song and dance from 7 in the morning to 10.
Wow.
When he gave up, and he said, he looked at me, he's a little Italian guy, delicious, and he said to me, I guess you really want to work, and I go, yeah, and he took me up on the floor, and he put me with the assistant foreman, whose name is George Rapp, and we're still friends. Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful man. And he was up on a baker, mm-hmm. which is scaffolding. Uh-huh. Anyway, he's standing up there with this other young guy, and we I looked up at him and I just, oh my God, he looks like a Nazi. And, you know, he jumped down, took one look, he looked at me, right? And, you know, and I was dressed for work. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't want you to think I was dressed
right.
like
no,
this.
No.
I didn't pull any of that. I remember a gal who did that, and I just, I don't know, you better cut that out. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he sat down, looks me over. The foreman said to the assistant foreman, you know, put her to work. And he goes, okay, you know, tough guy. And he showed me what to do. So I got onto the baker with this young guy, and it was really simple. You know, the black iron was already up, and all we were doing was clipping the aluminum studs that go across for the ceiling to be attached to that. You know, it's not that complicated. It's just clip, make sure it's straight, and you just work the way down. And then I did that for. Almost a week once we were finished in the floor. And then George, who was the assistant foreman, is the one who started teaching me and showing me how to do the work on the job, and which is why we are like the best of friends. He's just a wonderful person. And the rest is history, because the company, after I was there for a week, of course, when the foreman found out that I knew how to use tools, you know, first your friend, right. You know, he was like thrilled, and they offered me, instead of the job being a week, I ended up working with that company a total of 3 years. Mm.
And what was the company? It was a company.
You know, because I actually have all that stuff written down. And they were great. I mean, I had a wonderful time. I mean, I have to say, all the years I worked in construction, did have some incidences, you know, but I had no problems handling it, because I'm very tough, and the men don't expect you to be very, very tough. And usually when you're dealing with male-dominated industries or professions, men tend to view women, you know, especially men, mother, daughter, wife, the dama four.
Right.
The dama four to marry, right? And except for who work, just too derogatory, you cannot use it. All these other projections that these men have are very useful, very useful, and they're good. I know a lot of women object, and I'm a feminist. I'm one of the early, you know, one of the people who helped build this movement in New York. A lot of women are like, well, you know, that's derogatory to women if you're mothering. We are mothering. That is part of who you are as a person. Men respond to that positively. You know, it's a communication that's going on between two people. They respond positively. So, but just also the fact, and I had a really good sense of humor, and I understood this world. I understood it, and I understood that there would be, like when you're an apprentice, there's a certain period of hazing that goes on. Not bad hazing, but you know, in the sense that you get the dirtiest and the toughest jobs. Yeah, hello.
Right.
Welcome to, you know, blue collar work. And so, you know, I didn't fall into any of the pitfalls and traps that were there for minority, especially for women. And at the time that I went in, I was the only woman working.
Right.
Because I went in as a minority, not as a woman.
And what year was that?
Oh, my God. Let's see. 70. And I remember how I met Irene. She was they had opened up the books. This is after
78.
I'd been there 3 years already. So I guess I missed 75, right? by then I was already in the union school and all of that. It took me almost 6 months to break that door down. Because they didn't want to let me in.
Yeah, because you were the first female, right?
Right.
Yeah. And, so.
But hired as a minority.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't counted as a female. Mm-hmm. They would have loved to have double dipped in that one. But I remember I was going in, I was older than a lot of the women who finally came in. Really political, which is why I started the two organizations. The first one was United Carpenters, mm-hmm. and then there was United Trade Women. Mm-hmm. Same name.
Well, it's interesting because we'll talk about that, but United Tradeswomen had a lot of activity with the Carpenters. I mean, that was the most active group.
It was, I'll tell you how United Tradeswomen started. We already had United Carpenters.
Tell me first then United Carpenters. But
United Carpenters,
I think
was
you should
me,
talk first.
Frank McMurray, Gaetano,
okay.
John Hart.
So first, let's stick to one subject at a time, which is you've got into the union. So apprentice program?
Yeah, after working, I've been working about 6 months. I'd been trying to get into the union, and I would go down to the union, and mm-hmm. he says, no, and I said, I have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, well, and I said, I have a job, mm-hmm. I have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And because the way it used to work is you couldn't get a job if you weren't in the union, you couldn't get into the union,
right.
You know,
I know,
catch
right.
But I had the job, and finally, they let me into the apprenticeship mm-hmm. program as a minority again, and, and it was great.
But you were taking the classes, right?
Yes.
The apprentice program.
You had to go to school at night, and you had to work. You had to have so many hours. In the Carpenters Union, if you didn't do so many hours of work per year, you lost, you'd lose your book, you'd kicked out of the union, and of course you couldn't go to school. Mm-hmm. So you had to have a minimum of a certain amount of work hours.
So now tell me, United Carpenter, did you start doing that when you were still an apprentice?
Well, the whole point, look, the reason in the leftist organization that I was in, they felt that I couldn't do any organizing in the construction trades because it was so male-dominated, white male, there's no way you can't organize it. And my argument with them is, if you're a good organizer, you can organize anywhere. Mm-hmm. What the hell does that mean? You know, mm-hmm. you're saying you can only organize in, I said, no. And so wherever I was going to work, I was going to be who I am, which is a socialist, and I was going to organize. And unlike a lot of the people back then felt they had to keep their politics hidden, and then kind of let people know somewhere down the road, I always disagreed with that policy because I know myself, I don't like somebody popping something out at me. I'm like, if I've known you for 10 years and all of a sudden I'm like, what? What do you mean?
Yeah.
What, you didn't trust me? Mm-hmm. That's not, I always thought at that time that was a very bad policy that a lot of socialist and Marxist organizations had. I was upfront. I said, if I'm gonna fucking overthrow the United States government, I'm doing it upfront.
Yeah. Okay.
Because my view was it's gonna be through leaflets, newspapers, through building. Mm-hmm. I mean, I still believe in that, through building mass movements. Mm-hmm. I'm not taking a long time. That's another story.
So, United Carpenter, you, Hart, McMurray,
it was actually Gaetano. It started. It was me and Frank first got together, because Frank McMurray was also socialist, and he wasn't in any organization. But we started talking, and I said, "Yeah, we need to build something," and then. He brought in John Hart and
Eugene Clark.
And Eugene Clark. Mm-hmm. And I brought in Gaetano, who was in my local.
Mm-hmm. And your local was?
I'm going to have to get my journal, but...
137?
I think so. Uh-huh. I was in the German local.
Okay.
In Queens.
Uh-huh. In Queens, okay.
Mm-hmm. In Queens. And so we started meeting and getting together. We came up with a name. We started mm-hmm. writing the newspaper. And we were doing everything. Mm-hmm. Writing the articles. I was the cartoonist. I wrote articles. We cartoons. We collated. We mimeographed.
Okay, so talk. So you're telling me about Carpenters.
Yeah, United Carpenters. We were in existence about, ask Frank, I'm sure he's got the dates better, about 2 years mm-hmm. before, and the way United Tradeswomen was formed was, it was me, Irene, Lois Ross, mm-hmm. Kathy, and I think...
Zidoretsky?
Yeah, Kathy Zidoretsky. I think that was it. Mm-hmm. We would get together for coffee at a coffee shop, and of course, you knew me, I was pushing it. I was mm-hmm. like, well, we need to have an organization mm-hmm. of trades women, because mm-hmm. there's so few of us in each of these trades that to form a carpenters group is not enough. Mm-hmm. We need to, make it United Trades Women, mm-hmm. so it's the women that we knew that were in, plumbing and mm-hmm. electrician and so on. So that's how that came about. We knew we were too small to. Yeah. And I really did feel that it was important that we have a women's group separate, even though, I could have said, well, let's, just. Let's all be in United Carpenters, mm-hmm. right? But I really felt that it really comes from a fundamental belief that I have, which is that women empower women. Mm-hmm. Men are wonderful and they love us and they can be encouraging and all that. Mm-hmm. But women empower men. Mm-hmm. Really strong political, but also, emotional support systems for all the women. So we were all very isolated. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'd be on a job and you'd be the only woman. In fact, for most of my career in the trades, I was mm-hmm. the only woman on a mm-hmm. job site. Every once in a while, when a couple of us got to work together, it was like, oh my God, yeah. like the celestial voices opened up, I don't know if Irene's ever told you the story of how she met me. She came onto my job site, mm-hmm. she was looking for work, and I just like, oh, what? Oh, this is great, I must have scared her. So it was just fantastic. And I just felt to really continue building the political momentum to get more women in the trades, because for women to be in the trades and succeed in the trades, there's such a wall against that, mm-hmm. And I thought without some political clout, what little gains we had teeny tiny gains, mm-hmm. right, would be wiped out, and that's turned out to be true,
mm-hmm.
Right. That's what's happened. There are fewer women in the trades today than there were mm-hmm. when I was in the trades, mm-hmm. So it's kind of sad. But a lot of it has to do with economics, too. Mm-hmm. Anytime there's an economic downturn or shakiness, first people to be kicked out of jobs, mm-hmm. Is women and artists. Mm-hmm. So, first is last hired, first fired. Mm-hmm.
So, United Tradeswomen, United Carpenters became Carpenters for a Stronger Union, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. it was mm-hmm. basically the same group, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so which do you feel like talking about first?
Whatever you want to.
What was the...
To me, it was the same thing.
I was organizing.
Mm-hmm. I was organizing from my perspective. Mm-hmm. I was up front with everybody. Mm-hmm. I'm a socialist. And from workers before an organization, so I didn't mince.
The Carpenters, those years that you and Frank and everybody were doing this work, that was the years of Teddy Maritis and mm-hmm. and then his...
Teddy Maritis had, let's see, okay, we were in existence for, I think, but he's still alive. Yeah, he was still alive, but then I remember he disappeared.
Right.
You know,
but you were organizing during that period.
Oh, yes.
Pretty clear that it was mob dominated.
Oh, absolutely. There was no question. The mob, and the mm-hmm. mob was moving into different locals. Mm-hmm. See, like 608 was the Irish local,
right.
So the mob didn't have its foothold in there. But the mob did take over the district council mm-hmm. because of Teddy Maritis. Mm-hmm. It's like they got their song. They'd been locals where they had a stronghold. Then they wanted to come into my local, which was a Queens local, mostly German. Mm-hmm. I remember when they sent, I'm trying to think, you know who would have this guy's name? The RICO Act people?
Oh, yeah.
In fact, they have a lot of tapes of me
mm-hmm.
because they had tapes and videotapes in my local's business office, in my business agent's mm-hmm. office. So I know for a fact that there's a tape of me refusing a bribe because the RICO people called me in one time mm-hmm. to ask me if I'd be willing to testify mm-hmm. against the mafia. I told them to go fuck themselves. They wanted me to wear a wire uh-huh. and pretend to be with the mafia.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. And I told them to go fuck themselves. I said, yeah, you know, a month from now, you'll be in bed with these guys. And where will I be? No.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also the...
What was the business agent? Who was that?
Walsh was his last name. Bob Walsh, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was cutting a deal. Mm-hmm. Okay. Our business agent thought that, the power in the Carpenters Union is going to be the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is what's happening. And he moved to align himself with it. He's dead now because he's pretty old. To align himself with that, and they sent this guy. I'm trying to remember his name. He actually threatened me once I refused a bribe. And he came from Frank will have all this mm-hmm. stuff. Frank is like.
Yeah.
Tons of records and stuff. Frank will be great because you'll get a ton of stuff from him. Anyway, he was sent from the mafia local into our local.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, one of these guys that you know has never done a fucking day's work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you want, take a look at my hands.
Okay.
Yeah. See those?
Right.
Those are permanent calluses. Mm-hmm. No matter what I do, I can't get rid of them. Mm-hmm.
This
guy, manicured nails, you know, the $300 shoes. I'm like, you know,
mm-hmm.
so he was sent into our local to try to, and so I was fighting against that.
Mm-hmm.
We were actually demonstrating. What we were doing is, we were agitating against the mafia. We were doing research. We were finding out that they were stealing from our pension
mm-hmm.
funds, that they had sold the Carpenter's home in Florida, you know, was all this land,
mm-hmm.
and it was a retirement home
mm-hmm.
that, for millions of dollars, poof, the money was just like gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there were no checks and balances. In our union, the union leadership could dip into any accounts that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's crazy. So we were writing, doing research, finding all this information out, writing leaflets, handing the leaflets out on jobs. We would slip copies of our leaflets under the door or through the mail slot of the district council. We would always slip them copies of our paper on the level every time it came out as we handed it out. It was a lot of fun, you know.
So,
yes, it was around this time, and we were, you know, we were threatened. They actually tried to beat up Gaetano. They did send goons to my local to. Supposedly they were going to beat me up, but John Hart sent from 608 IRA goons, and our goons were bigger than their goons. It was great, because these guys, when I went to my meeting, I know that night, but when I went to the meeting, these two guys came up to me, 6'5". You know, red-handed, you know, two mountains, and you know, and they introduced themselves, you know, they just, oh, they didn't tell me their names. They had their union cards, because you cannot get into a union meeting without your card, right? And they came up to me, and they said, you know, John Hart sent us, we're here, and I went, okay. No other conversation. These guys are serious business, right? And so I went into the meeting, these guys came in. They each sat on either side of me, so looking, you know, and my business agent, the jerk, started stuttering. He used to stutter when he'd get really upset, and he was like stuttering and spitting and saying, "Oh, well, people from other locals shouldn't be here," you know, because everybody knew what was going down. Yeah. You know, it was like, yeah, okay, what are you gonna do now? After the meeting, you're gonna beat me up? Well, take a look at these guys. Let's see what's gonna happen. So that didn't. I didn't get beaten up. I did bring a case against my business agent, which I won.
Mr. Walsh?
Yeah, okay. I won against the union,
And what was that case?
The case was that my business agent had come up, I was working on the 59th Street Bridge, and he came, I had been handing out leaflets, just normal, my normal stuff that I had always done. This was the one, questioning where monies were, that monies were disappearing. Follow the money, right? And he came up to the job site, and he brought over my business, my shop steward, who was, my shop steward was also kind of like a fentanyl criminal kind of person. I'd worked with him before he was a shop steward, and he told me, you know, I'd gone to jail for manslaughter, but really he had been doing a job. You know, he'd gone into the bar to kill the guy, and did a nickel. And this job, this guy who was in my local was now my shop steward. I guess he got a little favor. And my business agent went up to the shop steward with me, and he had the leaflets. He says, "Did you have you been handing these out?" And I said, "Yes." He knew I had. You know, I still even signed my stuff, right? And he tells the shop steward, he says, "If she keeps fucking around, you throw her off the bridge. You hear me? You throw her off the bridge." And I looked at him, I'm smiling, I'm going, "Eh, okay." So lunch was called. I got off the job, you know, went down off the bridge, went to the payphone, called my labor lawyer, and right then and there did a deposition. You know, I told him what happened. He says, "I'm taking a deposition
that
now."
You were threatened.
But my business agent.
And do you remember who your lawyer was? It wasn't Burton Hall by any chance.
Yes.
Oh, it was.
Burton Hall, yes. Okay. I'm trying to. I was just about to say, he was wrinkled and scruffy, and he slept in his office.
And he had
always,
big blue eyes.
Yes, he was wonderful.
Yeah,
Burton Hall.
Right.
And he took the deposition. We brought the case, went to court, and we won.
And what did you win?
What I wanted, you know, because they thought I wanted money. Fuck, making good money. I didn't want money, and I told them I don't want any money. Because they said, "Well, how much do you want?" Their lawyer, the union's lawyer, says, "I don't want any money. I want an apology from my business agent, from the union floor, and a statement by the union that we are allowed free speech." Allowed to give out leaflets, we are allowed to print our newspaper and hand it out on any job site.
So did you get that?
Yes! Oh, God, you should have seen when he had to apologize to me. It was like, yes, it was so wonderful. It was very good.
And it was at a big union meeting?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was packed. Packed. And the whole point of that was for the people not to be so afraid. Mm-hmm. I mean, so many of the men were so intimidated mm-hmm. by the fear of goons, by the fear of being beaten up, by the fear of being killed, you know, mm-hmm. which is, you know, right. bottom line, mm-hmm. what you're being threatened with right. is death, you know. I mean, I remember when the mafia killed two guys over Mongo. I mean, it was like, what? And this is, I was working at the
Commodore. What's Mongo?
Scrap metal from big job sites. Okay. And they get a lot of money, mm-hmm. and two construction workers were taking some themselves, you know, mm-hmm. the scrap metal, and the mob threw them off the building, you know, so mm-hmm. that was...
Mm-hmm. Serious?
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. It was
so what kind of response did you get from people when you won this case and they had to apologize?
Oh, the guys loved it. The mm-hmm. guys, they were really good response. I mean, the guys thought it was great, you know. A lot of people were just, you know, very, wow. Mm-hmm. And they were just amazed that we were able to agitate against them and speak against them from the union floors, in the paper, and not one of us got thrown off anything, mm-hmm. And the only one that they tried to hurt was Gaetano, and he mm-hmm. beat the crap out of the guy, which is fabulous. Can't crawl like that.
He's solidly built.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's a fighter.
Well, yeah. It's not a good idea to attack people who are very strong and who've got tools.
Yeah. So, what do you think the impact of CSU was on the union?
I think the impact was it actually helped bring about the receivership. I think that really was our main impact because, you know, we never got really, really big. I mean, we did have, you know, people come in, you know, but we never got to the point of being like a mass movement within the Carpenters Union. So I think more what we were doing is, you know, kind of like going after them. And I think we are part of what helped put them in receivership because we were doing some pretty damn good research.
Mm-hmm. The receivership didn't happen for a long time, right?
The receivership happened, let's see, Tetanus was killed, and then it disappeared. And then I think we went into receivership, I think it was about 3 years after that.
After Pascal McGinnis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, there was that shooting, you know, with...
Johnny Hart. I mean, O'Connor. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And that was the Chelsea... Mob and the Mafia, you know, fighting because
Westies.
The Westies and the Mafia were fighting for control of the district mm-hmm. council, and really what they were fighting for was access to the cookie jar because there were no rules about, you know, mm-hmm. keeping track of the money, who had access to mm-hmm. these monies, you know, and so that was what that battle was about, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know. But I think, you know, what impact did we have? I think that would, you know, Frank may have a different opinion, but I do think that was one impact that I think mm-hmm. we did contribute to that, and, you know, by agitating and by researching and writing and exposing. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah. I have a question about the strengths or limitations of CSU, but I mean, obviously, I mean, a built-in limitation is that it's not something for everyone. Everybody's not willing to stand up in a mob-controlled unit.
I think that's the main limitation mm-hmm. of all organizations. Yeah. Look at people today. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's very hard. And personally, I don't recommend it. Mm-hmm. As somebody who does do it, it is difficult to stick your neck out and to be the little person or the one person or the small group of people mm-hmm. to stick your neck out at a time when you know it's going to get chopped off, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But the reality is mass movements don't really come from the sky.
Mm-hmm.
They come, you know, there's all these little things happening before that.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, you know, well, people think mass movements are just like one day
yeah.
everybody wakes
gets
up.
Gets fed up, right?
No. It's like yeah. solidarity. If you study mm-hmm. solidarity, it happened in Poland. But I think our limitations were precisely that you know, it was asking people to stick their necks out
mm-hmm.
in a situation where it wasn't a question of losing your job, it's a question of losing your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what mm-hmm. what you were facing. You know, I mean, that was a reality.
I know from talking to Frank over the years that one of the things that he talks about is the small number of women who did. I mean, of course, in truth, there were a small number of men who did it also, but very few women took part in the CSU activities. And you want to speak directly about the experience of the women with I did. You know Barbara Trees?
Yeah.
And you worked with her,
yeah.
and she was another brave soul
yeah.
who stood up.
And again, for the women, they were in a super, super difficult position
mm-hmm.
because there were so few of them. They were trying to come in to this really hostile industry,
mm-hmm.
hostile to them, co-workers being hostile to them, and to then jump out and well, you know,
mm-hmm.
I was able to do it because I walked in with an organization mm-hmm. behind me. I walked in with Fight Back. I walked in with Workers' Viewpoint Organization. You know, I walked in with an entire history of activism
mm-hmm.
behind me. So, you know.
So you already had connections that you could talk to and get support from.
Absolutely,
and
absolutely.
Not feel
I
like
didn't
you
go in alone.
There,
I did
yeah.
not. I don't feel I went alone.
Mm-hmm.
I had this whole community of
mm-hmm.
people, my tribe, my
mm-hmm.
socialist tribe,
yeah.
you know. And by the way, I started in the Young Lords.
Ah.
And then I went to a comité.
Uh-huh.
And then from a comité to and it's interesting that I helped build a comité and helped build Workers' Reform Organization because it started out of a study group. But for the women, they were really in almost an impossible situation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why, you know, a lot of women, and that's why I thought a women's organization
mm-hmm.
made up of all tradeswomen, which would give us numerical
mm-hmm.
numbers,
right.
you know, more than
yeah.
we had individually in our trades, and then we could really address the real issues for women because, you know, Carpenters were strong. The union really was focused on the Carpenters Union,
mm-hmm.
cleaning up the union. That was kind of like the main thing. And it really wasn't going to address women's
mm-hmm.
issues. And I thought those were important,
mm-hmm.
which is why I did that. You know,
mm-hmm.
So I think that's really why
mm-hmm.
it wasn't. But women did participate. I mean, did,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of women came out.
United Tradeswomen, talk about some of the things that were important to you about the work you did with UT.
Well, I think what was wonderful, we organized the first conference on sexual harassment before it was even being called sexual
mm-hmm.
harassment. We also organized a conference where the original Rosie the Riveters were
mm-hmm.
able to come and speak
right.
to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we organized conferences on women in non-traditional employment, and they, oh, it was wonderful, these women, they were like, you know, in their 70s, and they were like, oh, God, they were fantastic. And we also participated and helped in organizing a conference of women in non-traditional jobs in California and San Francisco, and out of that conference, one of the things that we voted on was for women in the trades to take a stance against nuclear proliferation
mm-hmm.
and nuclear war. And we did that. I mean, I, you know, because these were diverse women,
right.
politically diverse. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, you know, people think everybody, it's like a monolith. No, it's not. In fact, I think of all the women that I knew in the Carpenters Union, I was even a socialist.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I expect to get arrested any day now. I won't be, well, you know, that happened to the radicals of the 30s. They were being put in jail in the 50s. A lot of people don't know this because they think of the Hollywood 10.
Mm-hmm.
No. It was little people that were losing their jobs and being put in jail. And, you know, all they had done was sign petitions back in the 30s. Yeah. So, and then out of that conference, when we took the position against nuclear proliferation, we were invited by the Soviet government to send a delegation of women, you know, not women, to go to the Soviet Union to stand for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, I was invited to go on that. I went in 1984. And I remember asking the Russian people, the committee that was organizing, if it would be all right if I could take my kids with me, you know, and I was going to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Russians paid for our going.
Mm-hmm.
And finally they gave me permission, then a couple of the other women did it, because I thought, this is an incredible opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not going to go to Russia again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were there for 3 weeks on this peace exchange, and my kids got to see the Soviet Union, and it's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Of course, when I was there in 84, I thought, oh my God, these people need a revolution.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I was never a Stalinist.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, never, you know, in fact, I constantly kept telling people, until socialism can offer more democracy than capitalism, working class America is never going to go for this.
Yeah.
And you can't be running around talking and writing like a 19th century Bolshevik.
Mm-hmm.
Which we, God, I remember that. I remember Lefa's, one of my favorite phrases I used to see on Lefa's. This is Maoist. This is my running dogs of the capitalist class.
Yeah.
We actually talk like that. Do you remember talking like that? I don't know about
there's
you.
There's an expression that will go over well in the bar.
I mean, you know, it's like, here's other terminology we used to use. I mean, I actually have found it in my journals. I laugh and laugh, and I go, oh my God. Lumpen proletariat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
False consciousness.
You know, I mean, this jargon that we just speak of. So, but I thought that Joyce Women did tremendous pioneering early on conferences. Nobody else was doing.
Right. And they got hundreds of women to participate.
Absolutely.
And there was a real momentum. And
Absolutely.
And it played a really big role in women's lives. What about its role in your life?
United Tradeswomen?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, it was kind of what it gave me, it vindicated the fact that you can do political work anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, doesn't matter where you find yourself, do what you've set out to do. That was number one. And the other thing it did is that, because feminist, it gave real emotional support. I mean, there were days, you know, you would be on the job and you get home from work and you'd call, and I'd call Irene, it's like, just venting, just able to call somebody who knew what you were going through, you know. So that was just so important. And it was my social base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these were my friends, you know, these were my women friends. And what I said to you earlier, that women empowered women. And, you know, kind of an interesting thing. I come from a a very long line of very dominant women. You know, I know people have the view that Latin mm-hmm. women are like,
yeah, subservient.
That's in the movies. Mm-hmm. It's a scam. It's not true. I mean, when you really get to know Latin women, mm-hmm. they run their families like this. Yeah. I mean, seriously, you know, it is a, it's a patriarchal society. It's also a matriarchal, mm-hmm. equal. In fact, I remember doing a paper in college on that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was very happily surprised to find out that one of my ancestresses was the founder of, and I didn't know this mm-hmm. until I went to Puerto Rico and started talking to my family. This was in 89. They've written a biography of her. Ana Roque
okay.
was the founder of the Puerto Rican Women's Suffragette Movement, mm-hmm. and she also was the first woman to publish a woman's magazine, political magazine, for a suffragette.
Mm-hmm.
She bought her own printing press, had herself trained, you know, had, you know, by buying the press, okay. somebody mm-hmm. teach her how to use the press. And her daughter was the first woman to vote.
Wow.
And by the way, women mm-hmm. in Puerto Rico had to vote before women in America, and she named her daughter America. Troque. Mm-hmm. Yeah, her name was Ana Roque, and mm-hmm. so she's one of my ancestors. It was kind of cool. And I was yeah. like, wow, that's mm-hmm. that's great to know that, because the women in my family, even though they
okay, this is take two, interviewing Connie Reyes on August 4th, and we're hoping for the best. So, okay, so talk about the strengths and limitations of United Tradeswomen, Connie. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think, you know, given the history of our country, you know, any group that is trying to improve people's lives is going to be seen with hostility.
Mm-hmm.
It just is, you know, because anything, we're the only, that I know of, historically speaking, the only country that's had a Red Scare before there were Reds.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we've created the Red Scare thing, you know? And I'm not talking about McCarthyism, mm-hmm. I'm talking about in the 1800s, when we had a lot of the utopian socialists in Europe,
mm-hmm.
in this country, there were people, you know, oh, these are, they're evil, mm-hmm. they're the devil, and you go, these are utopians, mm-hmm. we're talking about coming back to the country, you know.
So given the political or the apolitical or the...
I think there's real hostility yeah, in yeah. this country historically, there's always mm-hmm. been that. And then, you know, the... real hostility towards women
mm-hmm.
worldwide, and then yeah. of course us mm-hmm. here. I think United Tradeswomen was a miracle, and it was amazing what they got accomplished. And I would say that, you know, the only limitations, if you want to say the organization had limitations, were the limitations exposed by the
mm-hmm.
larger society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, you know, it would have been great if we could have been a mass movement, but part of the issue was that we were tradeswomen,
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
that, again, was going to limit us to where we were.
There was
who
a
we were.
There was a lot of, because I have the papers that some of the women have donated to NYU, mm-hmm. and I've gone through them, and there was a real effort to work with other women's organizations
yes.
in New York,
yes.
and there was even
in
almost...
In fact, the sexual harassment conference was...
Mm-hmm.
done in conjunction with other groups.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, that's a hard thing to do, once again. But,
well,
you know.
when, you know, the dominant ideas and the dominant philosophy of a society is always the ideas and the philosophy of the ruling class,
mm-hmm.
whatever that class
mm-hmm.
happens to be.
and sometimes it's a Catholic church, you know, medieval times. Mm-hmm. And it's very, it is absolutely an uphill battle fighting that. Look where we are today, and not just women in trades, but this whole country where we're at. I mean, it's just unbelievable. To me, having grown up in the 50s, I'm there's no question in my mind. It's like, whoa, we're in another McCarthy era, you know. But now it's, instead of being a communist under your bed that you were supposed to be afraid of, now it's anybody who's an American. Oh, therefore the terrorists. Mm-hmm. If you're attacking President Bush, you're, mm-hmm. I mean, people are being arrested for
since you're talking about the time, I mean, that was a fairly exciting time, even though, you know, the 60s was more exciting in terms of organizational mm-hmm. activity, but the 70s was still, there was a lot of activity going on. I mean, compared
absolutely.
To now.
Absolutely. It was, we were, it was a time of movement.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, I think we're in a time of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And people are just, now people are moving. People, there is mm-hmm. movement. I was saying to some of the women that I know, women in black, because we stand there, you know, we stand silent, mm-hmm. we kind of chit-chat, you know, to each other. And I was saying, because there was one lady who didn't have the experience of demonstrating mm-hmm. this in Vietnam.
And you do that once a week?
Yeah, every Friday, in front of the big sign that says, "Welcome to Bandon."
Okay.
There are these, there's like, usually it's about 10 of us, there's like these 10 old crows. Mm-hmm. That's how I describe
you
it.
You hardly
black.
Look like an old crow.
Thank God for Clairol. Anyway, and this lady who's with us, and she didn't have that experience at mm-hmm. no more. It's like, she's feeling disheartened. This girl, oh, there's so few of us. I says, oh, I was standing with her. I said, honey, let me tell you, the very first anti-war demonstration I went to in New York City against the Vietnam War, there was about 70 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And people were looking at us like we were nuts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, who are these kooks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is in the early, this was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. It was in 1960.
One of the first, just to get your history straight here, one of the first demonstrations that I know was at the World's Fair. Was that wasn't the World's Fair demonstration? Because people were protesting
we,
out there.
The first demonstration I went to, uh-huh. which was very, very small, we were in Times Square.
Okay, Times
and
Square.
And we were
yeah.
kind of like uh-huh. marching around uh-huh. there yeah. and... People were just kind of, but it was around the time of the World's Fair and stuff.
Right.
And they were like, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way I joined the demonstration was I met this girl when I was visiting, who ended up being my future husband, in Fort Dix. He was stationed at Fort Dix, and I was taking the bus over from, you know. And I met this girl who was going to see her brother, and you know, these boys were having a bit more. And she started telling me about, you know, there are people who really are against the war. And I said, really? And I thought, oh, that's great, because I hadn't heard anything, you know, because at that time the media didn't. And that's how I got into it. So I was going on the bus.
Mm-hmm. But so,
and then look, within a few years,
mm-hmm. right.
you know, of course, some people will say that the demonstrations have no impact on ending the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't
be one. And I don't agree.
I don't agree
either.
So we're talking about that time, and mm-hmm. that I mean, there was even a women's movement, even though it wasn't like just what
we
think
of.
Oh,
and I was part of that.
Right.
I was I was in the women's movement, demonstrated with them. You know, lots of different demonstrations, spoke at different conferences for them. In fact, I remember they asked me to speak at Radical Economists Conference.
Uh-huh. I think
on Martha's Vineyard, of all places.
Yeah.
I was like, I'd never been there, and Esperanza Mortel, I don't know if you know Esperanza, she was a very big actress mm-hmm. back then, also, and she was in the comité with me,
And in fact, the FLAN came out of them there. Mm-hmm. I knew some of the people who broke off from us and decided to go in that direction, and we were saying, no, don't do this. Don't do this. This is not what is the right thing. It's organizing, organizing, educating and organizing. Getting people to wake up and see what's really happening. But, you know, taking matters into your own hands and nothing wrong. But I knew that people were.
So, well, speaking of demonstrations, Connie, were you at the tradeswomen's demonstrations? There were two.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
I was at all the demonstrations. I helped organize all of them. You know, I should look them up because all this stuff is boxed up. But, you know, having moved to the country, when I look back at my calendar, you know, the little calendars that we kept our phones, I just go, oh my God. Oh yeah, I was younger. Because I was raising two kids and you know, very involved politically and working full time. And now I don't have the energy to do any of that.
And working at a hard job.
Very hard job, very hard job. But I love the work. I really love the work. I'm very physical. You know, I've always been a jock. So it's, you know, so that part was really cool. I really liked. But you can see, you know, I've got scars and scars up my head, fractured this wrist, all the body injuries.
So were you able to? Well, first of all, I want to hear a little more about the demonstrations because I had suggested, and you know, one of the things that's happening now with tradeswomen organizing in New York City. They're talking about the debate about whether or not they should go out on the street and organize. I mean, you know, and bring their message to the job site or bring their message to different...
Absolutely.
And so what was that like and what did that accomplish?
I don't think there's any choice. You have to bring the message to the street. You have to bring the message to the job site. You have to hand out those leaflets. You have to talk to people. You know, when you're sitting in the shanty, I was always talking to the guys, you know, problem about it, you know. But again, remember, I'm coming in, when I came into the union, I was coming in from these organizations, from Fight Back, from, you know, so the guys were a little bit, ooh, you know, what's going to happen, what's going to do, you know. So I was coming in not alone. I never felt that I was alone, and I wasn't coming in, I didn't feel from a position of weakness, you know, for a job. No, just from, really from a position of weakness. But I also feel that we were more hopeful then. Women had more hope, and we had more strength because there was a women's movement, you know. There was, there had been the anti-war movement. There had been the civil rights movement. There had been all of this social firmament. That's a good word for me. And so I would say for the women who are debating this, hey, I'll fly back to New York and tell them, hey, take the streets, hand out the leaflets, put the word out there, keep standing up, keep standing up, keep standing up. Because if nothing else, look at the history. We're still alive. The mafia didn't kill us. I mean, if they didn't kill me, don't worry, they're not going to kill you. I mean, you know, we were
But I mean,
totally
what does it do to present your position in a public way by, what did that accomplish for you? What does that do?
Number one, what it accomplished, I think, is it did educate, number one. Number two, it empowered us. It empowered us. And we, like for instance, the women, you know, United Tradeswomen, the conferences we did with other women's organizations. Honestly, I believe it's from us, from that root, that later on you have the awareness and the consciousness of, you know, sexual harassment on the job. We were the first to talk about it. We were the first to, you know, actually have conferences on it. And, you know, when the Anita Hill hearings happened, we were one of the foundation. We were actually one of the foundation stones for people's outrage of that, because people were outraged. Even the media was outraged at what they were looking at, weren't they? So, I honestly, and not just United Tourism, but all the women's organizations that were agitating at that time. Because if we hadn't existed first, no one would have been outraged at what happened to Anita Hill. It would have just been same old, you know, business as usual, right?
Yeah.
So that was, personally, that's a major accomplishment. And it's like, okay, in some ways, I would say the benefits that women have now, because they're getting it really fast, okay? But the idea that young women today, right, will go to college and their view is everything is available to me. That didn't exist when I went to college. You know, how about when you went to college?
Absolutely. I said to a woman doctor the other night who's head of the psychiatry department at this hospital in Eastern Washington, I said, and so what about the gender? You know, how do you see it as a woman? And she said, I don't look at the world that way. And I said, good for you, because, you know, in my lifetime, that you don't have to.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. That here we have a generation of women who have been raised to believe that they are entitled to opportunity. I'm of the generation where you couldn't get a bank loan as a woman. Right. You couldn't get a credit card by yourself as a woman.
Yeah.
Okay? So there have been real positive changes, positive improvements. But like Faludi wrote in Backlash, let me tell you, forces of evil and darkness.
Yeah.
The Republican Party. I don't throw the Democratic Party in there. I used to, but they're such weenies.
Well, you know, since you brought up Susan Faludi, and I think it's...
And by the way, I read her entire book. I know most people say, not everybody reads that book.
Good writer. Good writer.
Yes.
But depressing subject.
And
you know,
the book was too long.
Yeah, it's a big fat thing. But important point, because, you know, I just interviewed a woman historian in Harlem for this book. And she made a point that I think is so important, which is that the left isn't really, has sort of, is not making real efforts to connect to white working class men. And, you know, and now you're somebody who's actually has done real organizing on the job,
I was
connecting
told I couldn't,
to,
and
you did. And, you know, don't, I mean, this
little
is
Puerto Rican,
I mean,
socialist.
The whole, you know, drive towards the Republican, towards conservatism, and the whole backlash against a lot of our, you know, gains. And so, do you have anything you want to say on that subject?
Well, the left abandoned, truly, I think.
The working class.
The working class! I used to even say this. I said, listen, the working class isn't the Lower East Side of New York. America is white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant. And if we're not reaching out for these people, you're not having any kind of movement. And one of my favorite things to say to them, we can't be running around like 19th century Bolsheviks here. You know? And the revolution didn't work in Russia either. Look where they are now. Because they used to get really mad at me. I said, no, no. I think that the reason so many working class people have gone to the right, okay? And you gotta take a long view and look at history. I mean, come on, the working class in Germany voted for the Nazis because they thought the Nazis were telling them, we are national socialists. We are for social reform. We're for daycare. We're for jobs. We're for, you know, home and family, blah, 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 right? Here you've got the Republicans. Classic, giving the same message to the working class. We want to give you security, safety, family, family values. Do you know who were the first people to quote family values, to use that term? It's the Nazis. Family values.
Wow.
That term. It's not new. I know everybody thinks it's new. No. It's not true. Joseph Goebbels came up with it. Brilliant man. Brilliant monster, but brilliant. So working people are looking for some way out of their terrible situation that they're in, which they are in, right? We've been in a 20-year, and I mean it, 20-year speed up, okay? Jobs, fewer workers to do the same amount of work, right? Over and over and over again, being paid less. Here in the Northwest, okay? Loggers used to get paid more money, and it's a very incredibly dangerous profession, because when I first moved here, I saw so many young men with missing arms and legs and fingers, you're like, what is this? You know? Were paid better in the 70s than they are today. In the 1970s, they were being paid, okay, a choke setter, it's a very dangerous job. This is the guy who sets the chains that hold the logs, you know. That thing break, you're dead. People have been decapitated by choke setters. Terrible, terrible. In the 1970s, they were being paid between $15 and $20 an hour. Today, in 2005, and it's more of a speed up, right? Because they're using littler crews, smaller crews, they're being paid $9 an hour. So working people are looking, they want that something's, you know, and along comes the Republicans and the religious right, and they're saying to them, you know, we're for family values, we're for, you know, father earning a good living and the mother staying at home and taking care of the babies, which is great if you want to do that. But I have nothing against that, by the way. But they're not getting that. They're just getting the bullshit. And they're being, I mean, royally screwed. Royally screwed. You know, the average working person in this country has no medical benefits. And their children have no medical benefits.
So what about on the question of backlash? Against
on the question of backlash against women is because the prevailing, remember, the views of the dominant group is saying, oh, our economic woes, our social woes are all it's because of feminism, it's because women have taken the good jobs, and that's why men cannot support their families, and that's why you have such a high divorce rate, or that's why you have so much, let's see, what are the social, promiscuity,
homosexuality,
the evil, you know. And it's funny because they want to look for a scapegoat. Who are the scapegoats? Traditional. Who are the scapegoats in society?
Minorities, women.
And children. And minorities. In a society, and this has been historically, I don't know if this is genetic with human beings, but the weakest groups are the ones attacked the most, are the ones penalized the most, are the ones who have to pay the most. I mean, it's people in the ghettos who pay the highest rents, not people on, you know, Park Avenue. A person on Park Avenue is actually paying less for furniture than a person in Harlem. I remember when I
read that book, The Poor Pay More.
Yeah, The Poor Pay More, and have you read the book, Nickel and Dime?
Oh, fabulous. Love it. 200 pages, it's brilliant. It's the best.
Right, yeah. That's why Faludi should have made her book much smaller.
It's fabulous. So I wanted to ask you now about the question of obstacles for women organizing in their trades today.
I think they're the same obstacles that we had in the 70s, but it's worse, because at least in the 70s, there were movements, you know, and there was still the belief, and I think the hope that, you know, that there was a possibility of change, that there was a possibility of reforming. I mean, one of the arguments I used to get into, the power of my best friend who just passed away. He didn't believe in reforms. He felt that if you were a socialist, you should never, never go for a reform, because reforms fool people into thinking that the system will work. And my argument with him was like, so what you're saying is we should let things get really, really, really miserable and that's when people rise up? Mm-hmm. No! Fight for reforms, because in the process of fighting for just human decency, people will wake up, because when they see they're not going to get it, even if they get a crumb, eventually, when a person gets a crumb, they want another crumb.
They want another
one. They're going to fight for another crumb, mm-hmm. right? And then for another one. So I think it's actually harder, much mm-hmm. harder, especially since there is this view now that women don't really have to fight for women's rights because they already have them. Mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. okay. You know, women are making less now than in the 60s in terms of male salaries and female salaries. We're actually, I forgot what the statistic, I know you can look this up, but there was a statistic about how much a woman earned and how much a man earned. And if a man made a dollar, the woman, I think at that time, was making like 44 cents, mm-hmm. something like that. I heard it's actually the ratio now is worse.
So now I want to talk about a little bit about assessing your career and all, and what year? Go ahead.
1987.
Okay, you left in 1987.
But I didn't let go of my book. I was attending uh-huh. union meetings here when I first moved here. Uh-huh. I kept my book until.
And did you do any work as a tradeswoman out here?
Yeah, I did. Uh-huh. I worked on a fish plant here, but I didn't know how to drive, mm-hmm. and my ex-husband was driving me back and forth, mm-hmm. and I realized that wasn't going to work, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that was going to be a problem. I worked on a building fish mm-hmm. plant over here.
But what led you to leave?
Actually, what led me to leave the trades was actual physical illness mm-hmm. that I couldn't, continue doing yeah. that work. I started to have, issues with, we thought I had cancer, mm-hmm. I was having cancer biopsies, mm-hmm. It turned out I didn't, I just had tumors, but mm-hmm. I had surgeries mm-hmm. and different things like mm-hmm. that. So it was really like my health, I was starting to have mm-hmm. health issues that were like, oh, this is, mm-hmm. And then what I was doing was I was self-employed and I was, buying a house and renovating and then selling mm-hmm. it. So I was still doing the trades, but not in yeah. to that level, you know, right. because when you're working, yeah. it's go, 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 mm-hmm. go. And so I was doing carpentry and it was great because I taught myself with videotapes because I'd never installed, I worked in construction in New York, mm-hmm. high-rise building, right? So I had never built a wooden house. Mm-hmm. I'd never put in a composition roof. So I would go to the hardware store and buy these tapes on how to do this stuff. Oh, and yeah. I'd watch the tapes and take notes, uh-huh. to learn how to install a roof. And, mm-hmm. In school, we had framed out a wooden house in the basement, which mm-hmm. is part of graduating uh-huh. to do this.
Oh, right.
But it's still really different. Yeah, you're still, when you're actually learning, because all the framing I'd ever done had always been in metal. Mm-hmm. So now I'm using wood, yeah. which is great. But so it was really learning this kind of carpentry, mm-hmm. which I had not done.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed mm-hmm. that. And I did that for 1994, when I decided to go back to school, mm-hmm. and the reason I stopped doing that is because the situation with my ex, mm-hmm. the marriage fell apart. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
we went back to school, mm-hmm. and how do you compare your two, your life? Is there any comparisons that you can make between your life as a tradeswoman and your life as a psychologist?
Absolutely, uh-huh. absolutely, because I think that my experiences as a carpenter and being in the trades absolutely makes me a damn good therapist. It in every way, it has shaped and formed my life. Mm-hmm. I think that the people that I met, the stories that I heard, you know, because one of the interesting things, having, I went into the trades, I'd already been a counselor, I worked in a women's clinic, Eastern Women's Clinic, so long gone, but it was like, people want to tell you their stories. People want to tell their stories. Mm-hmm. We're still all storytellers. Mm-hmm. And to me, it was wonderful. I learned so much. I learned so much about life, about people. Because here I was working with white males, mm-hmm. which I really hadn't had that much access. You know, when you grow up a minority kid in New York, mm-hmm. it's interesting how kind of insulated are, mm-hmm. right? And was able to and have friends. I mean, be mm-hmm. real friends with these men and mm-hmm. learn so much from them. And they were wonderful. I love their stories. They were wonderful, wonderful people. And I knew this in my heart. I knew in my heart that no matter where you are, you can organize. Mm-hmm. No matter where you are. You can speak your truth, mm-hmm. whatever your truth is, right. mm-hmm. can, mm-hmm. you know, and people will hear you. Mm-hmm. As long as you're speaking yeah. your truth, and that it is true, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talk about aliens landing, I don't know about that one.
So, I wanted to get your thoughts on affirmative action, and such as it is, but, I mean, it's really, so changed, so, but,
I remember Baki.
Uh-huh, right,
Baki,
yeah.
And I was like, oh my God.
I found a copy of that in Burton Hall's papers, mm-hmm. the whole decision, Baki decision. Mm-hmm. Do you have anything to say about, first of all, the contributions of affirmative action?
You know what? How about this one?
Okay.
Fucking Clarence Thomas would not be where he is without affirmative action. Mm-hmm. You know, that pervert is mm-hmm. on the Supreme Court because of affirmative action. So that might be enough. They ain't going to college.
Mm-hmm.
They are not. Poor mm-hmm. blue collar guys, they're not going to college
right.
here in the Northwest.
Yeah.
So absolutely I believe in affirmative action. And it needs to be done better and more mm-hmm. than what we're doing, than what we used to do. Mm-hmm. Here's what I find fascinating. When I was growing up, there was a philosophy or an idea, let's put it that way, in the air, the ether, whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it, that poverty was created by bigger structures, mm-hmm. by the government, by industry, mm-hmm. by big business. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, it's like we're back in the 19th century, in Dickens' times mm-hmm. of, if you're poor, let's put you in debtor's prison. Mm-hmm. It is your fault you're poor. It is the choices you made. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for your poverty. You're responsible mm-hmm. for where you're at right now. It's like taking a human being out of context of the society they live in and the time that they live in. And I get so upset when I hear, these commentators on the radio. And by the way, I do listen to the right wing radio because most of it is right wing. I remember a year ago on Thanksgiving, one of the right wing commentators here in Oregon was talking about, these welfare bums and they want to go and get their free turkey. And it was like the most pernicious and just. And listening to this guy, I was in the car and listening, I'm going, when did this happen? When did we go back mm-hmm. to that 19th century mindset, mm-hmm. what happened to the war on poverty? What happened to knowing Moynihan? Moynihan mm-hmm. wrote this incredible paper back in the early 60s
right.
on how poverty was created in New York City, how banks redlined neighborhoods mm-hmm. and created bombed out buildings. Mm-hmm. The banks, mm-hmm. not the people who were being mm-hmm. blamed for it. So I think that you know, we're living at a time where the brutality, the naked brutality against the working class in this country is just wow. I mean, truly, we're not going back to the 50s. Mm-hmm. We're going back to the 1800s. Mm-hmm. We're going back to a time where if you don't show up, you know, what was the saying? If you don't show up on Sunday, don't come back. Yeah. Come on Monday. Remember
show
those
on
things?
On Monday, right.
Yeah.
The Irish, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we are at a time where facts, these mm-hmm. are facts, where women are so frightened, you know, and the economy is so bad that they are allowing themselves to be sexual. Mm-hmm. Sexual harassment is alive yeah. and well. Yeah. For a fact. Facts. These are facts that, I mean, and I think it's, you know, I empirically I can tell you what's going on yeah. in my town.
Right.
What I know is going yeah. on, okay? I've had women come to me and tell me horror mm-hmm. stories. Okay. And Clarence Thomas, let's get back to Clarence Thomas, a little affirmative action guy, was one of the instrumental people, along with Anita Hill, of decimating mm-hmm. the Labor Department. So there's my sister is a labor investigator mm-hmm. for the Labor Department, and she says it's amazing, you know.
In Washington?
No, in Orlando,
oh,
Florida.
Okay. Uh-huh.
She's amazing. I love her. And she says, we have no power. She says, I just kind of pretend that I have power and I scare these people, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
She says, really, we
yeah.
have no power.
No enforcement.
And she said, no enforcement, mm-hmm. and she said, in Orlando,
mm-hmm.
business owners literally are treating workers like slaves.
Mm-hmm.
Slaves. My sister was very instrumental in that big lawsuit against Taco Bell,
mm-hmm.
where they were having the employees punch out. This is something that used to be done in the garment factory.
Right.
Punch out and you stay, and they weren't paying them overtime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Huh. Go to Walmart, see how the world order.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we're at a very tough time. But it's also a time of opportunity,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because history repeats itself. And as the fist comes more and more out of that mm-hmm. velvet glove, and you can lie to people, mm-hmm. and you can tell them you're for family values and blah, 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 and all of this, you know, and like Bush does and mm-hmm. the Republicans do. The bottom line is, when a white man can no longer feed and clothe his family, at that point,
mm-hmm.
right, that is the most dangerous man in the world. Okay? That. Not the socialism. No, that is the most dangerous man in the world. Just like these young men who are strapping bombs to themselves mm-hmm. and blowing themselves up. You know, I know people go, ooh, terrors, they're evil, they're the devil, right? Let's back it up here. Where did this person come from? How did this person come to that moment? That time and space,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's step back a little bit. Oh, gee, our government, in collusion with these oligarchies and these, you know, fiefdoms in the Arab countries, in collusion with them, are totally creating an impossible situation where there's no hope, no chance of opportunity, no job, nothing. What do you think is going to happen? You can't take and oppress people and then think that they're never going to do anything about it. They may, you know, people may take oppression, maybe even for years, okay? Eventually, they rise up, even if you're the most oppressive state on the planet. Spartacus rose up against Rome, the absolute most despotic, boom, right? So I do think this is a great time of opportunity, too, because as, especially as this pernicious and illegal Holocaust that we're committing and perpetuating against young boys and girls of America, boys and girls of Saudi Arabia.
So
that goes on. People will wake up. You're hearing parents. Did you see that thing on 60 Minutes where there was this woman who was she was a jobs counselor and she was rah rah rah, my country. Yes, we got to go. Saddam Hussein, 9/11. That whole she bought the lie. She bought the lie. And in fact, she works in Detroit and she was somebody who always encouraged. As a way out, the military to her was.
Well, there was a woman like that in Michael Moore's movie.
That's her. Okay. That's her. That's one of the. She was on 60 Minutes also.
Oh, okay.
And
I didn't see her on 60 Minutes.
Yeah. And she. Her baby died. Wake up call.
So, what about your thoughts on women in the skilled trades now? I mean, the importance of it as a...
I still think that it is absolutely essential for the higher-paying, blue-collar jobs to be open to women. I was able to give, which is why I went in. I went in for the money. You know, I know some women had other, you know. No, I wanted to provide my children a middle class lifestyle.
And you were able to.
And I was able to. I was able to buy a house. You know, I was able to send my children through college. I did all that. I did that. You know, with what I earned. In fact, on the jobs, when I would go on a job and guys would, well, you're taking a guy's job. You know, there would always be that initial, you know, getting to. I mean, after I was in the trades for a lot of years, everybody knew me. So it was like, ha, you know, they have to go through that. But when I come in, a guy's, you're taking a guy's job. And I used to look at whatever guy would say. I said, oh, honey, hey, if you're willing to support me to stay home and support my kids, I'll sign on the dotted line. Hey, I won't have to come and bust my ass here. Great. Come on. Give me your paycheck, babe. I'm here for the same reason you're here. I've got two kids. I want to support them. I want to give them a better life, you know? And sorry, I don't have a poppy to support me, but if any one of you guys in the crew wants to sign on, you can support me. I won't sleep with you, but you can support me. I used to have a lot of fun. You have to have a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
You know.
Goes a long way.
And be fast on the uptake. I remember one job, where a guy was like, oh, you can't do the work, you know, we're going to have to carry you. You know, and he was going on like that, and he was just, you know, some guys would just get into the thing, right? And I go, no, you don't. And we were all in the shanty, and some of the guys already knew me. And I went up to this guy, and this is really easy to do, of course. And I got to show it. It's so cool, right? I went up to him, right? And he was a little bit taller than me, you know, about like 5'7", 5'8", right? I went up to him, and I went like this. Put my arms around his legs, and I did a deadlift, which is easy to do, by the way. And I walked about 4 steps, and I put him down. I said, I think I can carry you. It's a visual aid, you know, because I could do the work, and I did. You know, I mean, I was very fast. I was very good. In fact, ask anybody, any of the men who ever worked with me.
So what about organizing now in terms of the women, and you know, because you've been there, and although you're a little distant from the tradeswomen's movement, but what words of advice do you have?
Basically is talk to each other, talk to each other, meet with each other, meet with each other, socialize with each other, very important, and just keep doing it. I mean, it sounds stupid and simplistic, and sometimes you feel like, oh my God, we're never going to make it. Yeah, because, and some of the young women today may look at me and say, well, gee, you guys failed. You know, we're still kind of reinventing the wheel in a way. And I'll say, no, we didn't. Okay? Because when we came in, that door was solidly closed. Mm-hmm. There are little cracks in that door now. At least people are willing to say, oh, yeah, there are women in trades, you know, a lot. But it's not like when I got the, in my day, oh my God, I'm so old. It's like when we get to say, in my day, for some buggies. The idea of a woman being in trades was just not even an idea. And the left was against it. The left, you know. Progressive people were actually against it, along with the white guy. You know, here's the interesting thing. Here are the progressives, and here are the, you know, the white union guys who don't want anybody in there, and they're saying, yeah, no women. There's two groups of people saying, yeah. For different reasons, but actually a similar reason, interesting enough. They both felt that the job should go to minority men. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, the white men wanted the job to go to white men, but the progressives were telling me the job should go to a minority man.
And that's still alive?
I think that particular little maggot is still alive and well. You know, there's so many ideas that are so toxic, right? Mm-hmm. Maggots throughout history, you know, from medieval times on, from Roman times, Victorian times, and here we are, you know, having to, like, sort out, you know, what do you really believe? Because in all of us, we've got all this programming and we're not even aware it's in there, you know, and then you're acting on it, or you're, you know, or it's being said to you, you know. And they were trying to make me feel guilty, thinking I'm entitled to a job just like anybody else who's supporting children, you know. And I had the kids, so I had, you know, kind of a... And they were my... By the way, my children were my incentive of why I went in that direction. Because I really didn't want to raise my children in poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, struggling and struggling. Mm-hmm. I wanted to just give them, you know, a better life.
Where are your children today?
My daughter lives in Portland. Mm-hmm. She's married. And my son is in Yokohama, Japan. He's been in the Navy for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And he's getting out. He says, I said, thank you, thank you, thank you. I mean, he's not at any risk of going to war, Navy, because of his specialty. He's a computer programmer. Mm-hmm. And he works specifically on nuclear guidance systems on nuclear subs.
Okay.
So he fixes the black boxes.
Mm-hmm. Your daughter, does she...
And she's a member of NOW.
She is?
Yeah.
Okay.
My daughter's the feminist, and I would say my son is a little bit more conservative, because, you know, he didn't only have my influence, he also had, and my daughter had, their father's influence, and they're Cuban. Very conservative Republicans. And but my son, I would say, is progressive. You know, he thinks this government is an abomination, and of course it's horrendous. But I would say he's more, he would vote. But they grew up, both my children grew up in the movement, and going to demonstrate.
Yeah.
They burn. They. I remember one time I was really sick and I couldn't go to a demonstration in Washington, and they wanted to go. They didn't want to go, so I sent them with my friend, and she was going with her son. And when they came back, they were so happy because they had burned the president in effigy, and they had a. This was a demonstration against apartheid in South Africa. So they had such a good time.
So So does your daughter know about you and your role in the, as being a tradeswoman and breaking down doors for women?
Oh, yes. Sure, yes. Sure. My yeah. kids, yeah. Uh-huh. They were, because they grew up, yeah. you know, right. meetings at the mm-hmm. house, and they grew up, and our house in Queens was also like a place where people were coming into New York City to speak, and they would mm-hmm. stay with me, because I had uh-huh. the space. I mean, we had, this is great, we had staying at one time, we had English coal miners who had come to speak mm-hmm. to the leftist groups mm-hmm. when they had they were having strike, that big strike right, in England, right. and the English were
the
hiring, yeah, and uh-huh. the English were hiring American consultants to bust the unions, yeah. the English companies. Remember
okay,
that?
Right, yeah,
yeah. So we had those guys were great. My God, could they drink? I don't drink, so it was like, whoa, and they were still standing. Great guys. I did cook for them. I had Chris White, who is...
Oh, I know Chris White.
You know Chris?
And the laborers.
Yeah.
Alaska.
He stayed at my house okay, when he came
great.
To speak yeah. about what was going on up there. And I ended up working with his best friend from high school on my job. Alan is his best friend, and Alan was talking one day about his friend from Alaska, because mm-hmm. Alan was a miner mm-hmm. in Alaska, and I said, well, you know, I've only met one Alaskan. So I'm telling him the story about the guy, and I didn't mention his name. And then Alan says, yeah, my friend Chris. I said, that's so weird. The guy who stayed at my house, his name is Chris White. And Alan says, my friend's Chris White. And I go,
wow.
Labor yeah, in the yeah. laborers mm-hmm. union was labor. He goes, yeah, and I go, and they shot him up, and mm-hmm. so he stayed at my house. And, my God, that man could eat too. I mean, I made a huge pot of rice and beans, you know, Puerto Rican food. He said, well, we're like that, you know.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Chris White and the laborers and your union, the carpenters, I wonder.
Yeah, I did go on my book about. When did I let my book go? I think it was in 94, because I felt like I can, you know, I'm paying. Unlike one thing I do like about the Teamsters, mm-hmm. which we don't have mm-hmm. and we should.
Get a withdrawal?
Yeah, the Teamsters let you freeze your book, and then you don't have to pay dues mm-hmm. anymore yeah. if you're not working.
Yeah.
We don't do that. Yeah. So it was costing me mm-hmm. like about, it was almost $400 a mm-hmm. year, and I just mm-hmm. thought, what am I doing?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. I'm
so the unions, I mean, one of the big problems with the industry that you were in New York is the corruption,
whew.
Which really, to use the word, undermine the mission of labor. Having come through that particular fight, and what are your thoughts on that?
The corruption in the unions is like the corruption on Wall Street and the corruption in the White House. This is a corrupt society, mm-hmm. and we do have, you know, there's corruption and there's corruption. The corruption in the carpenters union is they were just stealing the money and they were behaving like goons.
Mm-hmm.
The corruption in the teachers union is more subtle, more hidden, but it's still corruption. You have unions, the leadership of the unions in this country, they're not for the workers, they're not for the labor, they're not for building unions.
Perpetuating their positions.
Yeah, they're in to jump into bed with the bosses. To me, the most classic example of that was the traffic controllers union.
Mm.
Okay, they were a very conservative union, and they were rabidly behind
Reagan.
I mean, right. man, I don't want to get disgusting on your tape, but they were definitely like, you know, let's get mm-hmm. in bed with you, right? Total Reagan whores, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing Reagan did.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, when I watched that, that truly should have been the wake-up call
yeah.
for all labor.
Right.
They should have opened their eyes. They
mm-hmm.
didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was one of his very first acts, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah. wasn't it? Right.
You're gone.
I have to ask you, because I'm doing a second book, and the subject is the reformers who worked with Burton Hall.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been interviewing all these
yeah.
people. So what do you have to say about the late, great Burton Hall?
Oh, he was wonderful. What a curmudgeon. He truly truly, truly stood. He stood, and he made the sacrifices that were required, which he did. You know, he sacrificed, if you really think about it, he sacrificed his financial well-being. You know, I mean, I met Burton when he was living in his office. You know, people walked in and went, are you living in here? He goes, well, I stay here sometimes. I'm like, you're living in here. I know.
He had a place in Staten Island. You know? He used to live there a lot.
Yeah, okay. And I was like, oh. And
now, did you meet him when he was on Liberty Street or up on Broadway, south of Canal? Do you remember which office? Because he was down by the World Trade Center, and he left when they were already, they had the big, you know, so that's why he had to leave down there. Anyway.
I think it was Liberty Street the first time.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was funny, smart, crazy as a coot, but incredibly, incredibly honorable. Mm-hmm. Incredibly honorable. I mean, that was my experience with him. I don't want anyone else to say, but this is who
pretty
I encountered. He, you know, was, and it's like, for me, having him, it was like, you know the old saying, you don't go into a gunfight carrying a knife, mm-hmm. right? And having him on my side, it was like, I knew when I went into the fight, and I knew who I was fighting with. Mm-hmm. I had never had any illusions. You know, you're dealing with organized crime,
mm-hmm.
you know. An arm of the government when they need them, uh-huh. or they want them. And having Bert, it was like I knew I had real high firepower, you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It was like that. It just, it made you feel strong. It made you feel, you know, like, yeah, kick your ass. You want to see my king? You're the mommy? Take a look. I had Bert, I had the IRA, yeah, these organizations, it was very nice.
Yeah. And you had Fight Back. We haven't mentioned James Houghton, but he's still going at it. Yep.
Really?
Still
oh my God, tell him I said hello.
Yeah.
He might actually know me more by Consuelo, because a lot of people call me Consuelo. Wow, good for them. Yeah, well, you can tell him I'm organizing here against the war, because I'm in... Women in Black, and you know, continuing that, and before Women in Black, before we had the chapter Women in Black, we were demonstrating against the war before the war started, and we had kind of a Bill of Rights group, but most of the people are not radicals, and me, I am, and I always say, yeah, that's my point of view, and you know, because. What's the bottom line, really? What is the bottom line? And Pedro Avizu Campos said this. Look. You cannot be pressed just in means. I mean, it's in Spanish.
Yeah.
It's not that Spanish, but it's, you know.
That idea. And James Larkin, the great Irish revolutionary, also said something. He said, it was about, you know, the ruling class, and so it was, you know, they're in their position because we're on our knees. Rise, rise, you know.
Exactly.
It's a beautiful quote. Yeah. I just can't imagine.
Exactly,
you know,
exactly.
I remember it exactly.
I have another quote that I really like, and it's one of my mantras, and it's from Eleanor Roosevelt, which is, no one can demean you without your participation.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And that's a fact. You know?
Yep.
If we stand, and a lot of times, you know, I mean, when you're young, you think it's always a question of fighting, 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 fighting. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Where did you stand?
Yeah.
Within yourself. Mm-hmm. If you say, no to any kind of tyranny, including your own, by the way, because they're little tyrants living in our own heads, and we beat the crap out of ourselves. You know, good enough. If we stand up to tyranny wherever we find it, however we do it, doesn't always have to be the placards and the big banners. You know, sometimes it can be as simple an act as refusing to get up from your seat on the bus.
That's right. And, you know, I think when hearing you speak about that, I mean, I think the tradeswomen, the individual tradeswomen on the job, by their many, many acts, right, they're standing up.
Yeah, showing up every day to work by, you know, doing the just doing the job. I mean, the reason I was able to organize was because I earned the respect of these men because I did the job. They didn't carry me. You know, I did the job, and I had, you know, a track record. Not like, I do want to tell you, I didn't start working like my first day on the job, you know, and start handing out leaflets.
No.
I got established. I was there. I mean, of course, they knew I was radical. I mean, there's no question about that because they'd seen me come in with fight back. So it's not like, you know. But not, it was, I was there to, I'm first year apprentice, learn the job, get into the union. Once I was in the union, then I started organizing. Yeah. Then, you know, started doing more. So just showing up to work. I mean, I even, you know, like, sometimes the most heroic thing, seriously, that a human being can do is just show up. And sometimes the most heroic thing a human being can do is not show up for work and say, no, I won't give you. So it can go either way. I think that we are heading for another time of upheaval and movement because the bad guys aren't giving us a choice. They never do, you know, they squeeze you and squeeze you and squeeze you and squeeze you and squeeze you until you go, oh, hey, you know. And I think that. We'll see. Once we're in Iraq, 5-6 years, you know, already it's happening. Kids are saying, "I want to go."
Right.
You know, and
and the military families are organizing. Not enough, but there's still a lot.
I think, you know, I think that there are, interestingly enough, and I saw it here on the news. There are a lot of fathers who were in Vietnam who are saying to their sons. Don't go. This is a lie.
They know.
You know? And these aren't political guys.
That's
way.
Right.
I'm not saying these are guys who demonstrated by fan. No, these are guys who went, did the thing, straight up, you know, and they are saying, you know, they're trying to talk their sons out of it, and when their sons go, they're one father, his here in Coos Bay, his son went to the military, died in a